Excellent. And this evening is another requested talk. But please, those listening overseas or even here, please don't give any new suggestions for the next month, because I've already got a whole heap of suggestions for evening talks. Sometimes I have to decide what will actually work, what will be able to be talked about for 45 minutes or what won't. So sometimes your suggestions may not be the subject of a Friday night talk, but I'm trying my very best. And this evening there was a couple of requests which came through just this evening, so I thought I'd give them some prominence. One person was asking me about how to deal with a sudden death in the family, and the other person was asking me about just a technical point in Buddhism. How can Buddhism reconcile that we accept reincarnation or rebirth as a fact, but we also say that there's no actual soul? Where do all those memories reside? So it's going to be about I don't like calling it theory, because I like anchoring all the talks I give here on real life, on experience, on practice, not on theory which you just take on trust, but something which you can know for yourself. And first of all, I mean, the experts on dying are the Buddhists. And there's a good reason for that. You know, the Christians, the Muslims, the Jews, they only live once. Buddhists, we reincarnate time and time and time again. So because of our greater experience of dying, we've done it many times. That's why we know much more. How can you really understand about death if you've only done it once? But when you've done it thousands of times like these Buddhists have done, then we are the experts. So we know what we're talking about because of experience. But number two is one of the great things about having this huge worldview about rebirth or reincarnation, and there's plenty of facts about that. That's one of the things when I first came over to Australia, what was that, 28 years ago now, I think, I was actually stunned that people did not have open minds. They had such a strong belief, almost dogmatic, which they would fight, that reincarnation does not exist. And I thought, my goodness, you don't even have an open mind to actually to check, you know, see what the evidence is. You take it for granted, one life, that's all we have. And sometimes I wondered why. Why is that sort of dogmatic belief only in one life and refusing to even look at any possible alternative? And it came to me that the main thing is the fear. The fear of rebirth and reincarnation. Because as soon as you open your perception to that possibility, it does change a lot of the way you look at life. But if you open your mind to that experience and that sort of that truth, which can be proved, then it does, and there's nothing to be afraid of. It actually opens up your life to this huge perspective of one life amongst many, and something like a death, even a sudden death, is not such a big thing anymore. If it's one death amongst many, you're going to get reborn again. Here we go again. Sometimes you live a long life, sometimes a short life, sometimes in the middle, sometimes poor, sometimes rich, sometimes as a girl, sometimes as a boy. Wouldn't it be really great if all those boys could remember the time they were girls? And all the girls remember the time they were boys. We would have all those people who were straight would remember the time they were gay. Wouldn't it be a wonderful world? Because what it means is we wouldn't have so much misunderstandings of the other. Somebody told me recently, I forget exactly the details, but they said there was one magistrate in Australia who went to jail for, you know, only for about 3 or 4 weeks. I forget what the crime was. I think she was innocent, but you know, she went to jail anyway. And she said that was the best thing that ever happened to her in her role as a magistrate, because once she had experience firsthand of going in those cells with those iron doors closing and being in prison, to actually feel it and experience it as a real person in prison, then that totally changed her attitude to her sentencing. Because she knew what she was doing when she sent someone into prison, whether it's for 4 months or 40 years. She knew what it was like. And she was suggesting, I think it would be a wonderful suggestion, that anybody who was going to send someone to prison should spend a month or two in there themselves. All judges, all magistrates, all lawyers, maybe more than a month. No, I better not get into that. There's too many lawyers in this room. International. But wouldn't it be great? Because then you actually knew what you were doing. You'd have experience of these things. And I think any judge, fortunately we don't have the death penalty here, every judge, before they were possibly could actually sentence someone to death, should experience the death penalty themselves first of all. Then they find out. That's one good way to stop the death penalty, wouldn't it? But the point is, experience is really important to take away our misunderstandings of what's happening. And surely the experience of what dying is, if we can only remember that, then when anybody died suddenly, or died in pain, or died at any time, we would understand exactly what was going on. And it wouldn't be such a shock. In fact, anybody who's rational, who goes on the experience of life, who knows, from what you've seen and what you've heard with your own eyes, know that we can die at any time. Was it a couple of years ago, just after a talk on a Friday night, a man came up to ask a question, who was just sitting right over there, and he died right in front of me. Here, in this room, are you afraid of ghosts? That's a silly thing to be afraid of ghosts. I remember just going to the old Benedictine monastery in New Norcia, because we're really friends with the Benedictine monks. We have all these amazing meetings. We talk secret monks' business with each other, because there's only two groups of monks basically here in Western Australia. And I remember just being showed one of the first times around the inner part of the New Norcia monastery there. Holy Trinity Abbey is its proper name. And that's an ancient building, so ancient and creaking. It's the sort of place you'd expect to see ghosts at night. So I was walking there with the abbot, the former abbot, Abbot Placid, and I said to him, are there any... Actually, I was leading him on because I know a lot about Christianity. And they don't believe in ghosts, because they believe that once you die, you go to heaven or hell or in limbo or something. But they don't believe in ghosts. So I decided to have some fun at the good abbot's expense. I said, are there any ghosts, in this abbey? It's very old. I'm sure many people have died here. And he said, no, Ajahn Brahm, we don't believe in ghosts. You don't believe in ghosts? No, we don't believe in ghosts. How about the Holy Ghost then? Ha ha ha, caught you. I'm just having a bit of fun with it, because they believe in the Holy Ghost, but not real ghosts. That's part of the Trinity. But anyway, the idea of even ghosts and people, this is all part of the fabric, of our life, of our world. It's out there. And there's heaps and heaps and heaps and heaps and heaps and heaps of ghost stories. Now, one of the nicest ones, you don't have to be afraid of ghosts, they're really good. One of those ghost stories was a lady, I'm not sure if she's here this evening, but she told me this story a long time ago. She was lived by herself. Not really by herself. She didn't have any other human friends. She had her dog. And she told me here, in front here, just after a Friday night talk, she said that she loved her dog. Her dog and her was basically the contents of the house. And she said one day she was taking her dog for a walk in the park or the reserve, and she didn't know how this happened, but she lost her fingering, in the park. As soon as she came home, she realized she'd lost this ring. It wasn't expensive, but it had sentimental value. So she immediately returned, traced her steps, trying to find her fingering. She looked everywhere, but in a park, there's just too many twigs and leaves and grass. You just can't find it. It's hard enough to find things in your house, let alone in a park. So After a couple of hours, she gave up. And then she just came home. A few days later, her dog died. And of course, she was devastated, because that was the being she was close to, she loved very much. And she swore to me in front here, saying, "Absolutely honest, Ajahn Brahm, I won't lie to you, not a Buddhist monk. I heard that dog many times in my house barking. I couldn't see it, but I heard it. And if you've had a pet dog, you know its bark. You know its bark is different than any other dog. You recognize that was my dog." She's heard it many, many times. It was always behind a door, around a corner. And she'd rush around the corner, try and open the door. She could never see it. She could hear it, though. But she was really wanting so much to see the dog that one day she was right in front of her front door inside the house, and she heard the dog barking just outside the front door of her house. And she was right there. So she immediately opened the door, trying to get a glimpse of her dear dog. No one was there. Completely empty. But she heard the sound there. And that's when she looked down at the welcome mat. And right in the middle of the welcome mat was her finger ring. It was a dog who found her ring. Once it was a ghost. True story. Very beautiful. There's nothing wrong with ghosts. They found all your lost things. Or another story about ghosts. My last story. I can go on forever talking about ghost stories. But these are very nice ones. There's a couple of people who were really, really strong supporters of this temple. They still are. I won't say who they are. But they were just a young couple, from poor families. And he was a bit of a builder. And he told me the way he got started in life, with his wife, the way he got the money to actually put a deposit down for his first house was when he was doing some renovating in an old house somewhere here in Perth. Remember those old houses? You can still see them, in North Perth, in maybe sort of Vic Park, on little stumps, and the houses on top. As he was walking past alone, he heard very clearly someone say to him, "Put your hand under the stumps right here." And there was no one around, so he checked himself. Did I hear that? And it said it again. "Put your hand under here." And he put the hand under the house where he heard the voice. And there he found an old tin. You know those old tins, like you used to have tobacco tins or biscuit tins? An old tin. And he drew it out, and in there was full of cash. The previous owner of that house had been hiding his money there to avoid paying taxes or whatever. But that was where he was stashing his cash. He died, but he wanted this guy to have a start in life. He was a very good man. And he took that out, and that's where he got the start in life. So if ever you go past someone or a house and you hear the sound, "Put your hand under here, put your hand under here," don't be afraid. It could be your lucky day. But most ghosts and things are very kind. But the point is that once we understand that these beings exist, once we understand there is more than just one life, once we take that on board, and the evidence is incredibly strong for that, then when somebody dies, what's happening? It does change the whole dynamic of a death. It's here they go again. Here we go again, experiencing once again the separation of somebody we love and care for. We've had a beautiful time together. And that idea of, yes, the likelihood is we'll have a beautiful time again. Why not, if there's reincarnation? The other idea is everybody goes to heaven. That would be very, very complicated. Especially those of you who are on your second or third marriage. Because if your ex is up there too, you're going to get into big trouble with them when you meet them again. Use your logic. It's very complicated that way, but the idea of a reincarnation is much, much more easy to understand. And it means that the death is not such a big thing. People who can remember their past lives, and there are many people who can. One of the things which they always say is that, number one, they're not so afraid of death. But number two, the whole meaning of life changes. If this is just one life out of many, if you can just, don't believe it, just pretend to believe it. Imagine that this is one life out of many. Even if you reject that idea, imagine it. How would you live your life when it's one amongst many? What would you do? Number one, the whole purpose of life changes. It does become far more spiritual and far more stress-free. You don't have to rush so hard to achieve an experience. Don't worry if you haven't seen the Great Wall of China yet. It will still be there in your next life. It's been there for hundreds of years. So take it easy. You don't have to have all this list. People have these lists these days, a to-do list before they die. Take it easy. You can finish it off in the next life or the life afterwards. In other words, enjoy this moment rather than worrying so much about the future. But the problem comes when we just believe in one life. We're so afraid of death because it would be fearful. Especially people think they haven't had the chance. 5 years, 10 years of age, some kids die. That's a tragedy. People think, so young, they haven't had a chance of life. As I mentioned here just a couple of weeks ago, I gave a talk about 2012. And there was this girl over in Singapore, she was very upset. She says, I'm only 15. No, 2012, I haven't had a fair go. If the world's going to end this year. It's not going to end this year. You know, that girl's got many, many more years. But if you think 15 years is all you've got in this life, it does feel a bit unfair, doesn't it? You haven't had a fair shake of the dice. So, it's not true. People who die come back again. And this is what happens when people remember these things. But because they can die young, middle age, old age, at any time. Once we understand that, we can actually accept it. Understanding leads to acceptance, leads to freedom. All come from understanding. Freedom from all this terrible pain which people feel. Look, there was this great story, I can't sort of beat it. It's in Opening the Door of Your Heart. But this was a story told to me by this old monk in the north of Thailand many years ago. It's a brilliant story. It's a story of the falling leaves. And it was such a good story. There was one lady over in Singapore. She I put this to like a video presentation because it meant so much to her. Another lady, when her father died, he was only about in his mid-40s. His father died. She wrote a song about it and performed it for me. She was a very, very skillful woman. But that particular story was of a monk staying in a jungle in Thailand maybe 40 years ago, maybe 45 years ago. And in those days, the monks lived in very, very, very simple accommodation. Just bamboo and thatch, that's all, in the jungle, alone. And this one evening, there was like a cyclone. It's a big storm, just like we have had recently up in sort of Port Hedland. And you may have heard the winds and what they do to the trees. So there was a big storm in the jungle one night. And whole trees were being ripped out of the ground, coming crashing onto the ground, really sort of heavy. Now imagine that you're just in a bamboo and thatch hut. No shelter at all. So that monk was meditating all night. No way could he go to sleep because one tree would fall down. If that was on his hut, he'd get either crushed. If you're not killed, Jesse wouldn't be able to walk and would not be able to go and get any help. That was really, really dangerous. So he was up all night. And of course, every now and again, he heard a great tree come crashing down to the ground. But he survived. That's why he could tell the story. And he told me the following morning he went out of his hut to see the damage. And he was very lucky. Many trees had just missed him. Big branches had come down within a foot of his hut. But what took his attention was not the trees, nor the big boughs from those trees which lay on the ground. What took his attention was the leaves on the ground. Because as you would expect, the leaves on the ground, a nice wind which gives the special effects of a storm. But what took his attention was the leaves on the ground, those which had been torn off the tree by the force of the storm. And most of those leaves on the ground were the old brown leaves. Along with those old brown leaves, there were many yellow leaves. Amongst the yellow leaves were even a few green leaves. And he noticed some of those green leaves were so bright green that told him that was just a shoot which had probably come out the day before. That too lay dead on the forest floor. And he looked up to see what leaves were left. And of course, as you would expect, most of the leaves still clinging to life on those trees, in spite of the storm, were the green, healthy leaves. But even though there were old, so there were green leaves torn off, laying dead, there were still some old brown leaves still clinging to the twigs, still on the trees. Old curly brown leaves were still alive, even though young green ones lay dead. And he realized that's the same with human beings. Sometimes kids die, and there's still the curly old brown leaves, and there's quite a few of them in this building today. You know, oh, you're a curly old brown leaf. Even you survive, while other young people die. And people would often ask, why? Why does that happen? Now you have the answer. The same reason why when a storm blows through the forest, it doesn't always just take the brown leaves. It takes some yellow leaves, some green leaves, and even some shoots as well. That's called nature, life, our world. And once you understand that story, you really understand it. This is truth, this is nature, this is reality, this is the life in which we live. You will also understand that the same is with human beings. When storms of death come through our communities, they don't just take the old people, do they? Middle-aged people, young people, even children, they die. That is our world. We have to accept that because it's truth. Once we accept it, that question why disappears. Acceptance, no anger, nothing's gone wrong. The wind, the storm hasn't made some mistake. This is our life. We accept it, make peace of it with it, learn from it, and grow. So if anyone who really understands that story, we should never get surprised when somebody dies at any age. And of course, I've been here long enough, and of course, being a monk, being a religious figure, I do those funeral services. And I've done funeral services for babies prematurely born, to old people in their 90s. I've never done anyone for over 100 yet, but I'm sure that's going to come soon. I've seen the whole range, because that's my job. And it's a privilege to be there. It's an honor to be there. And I'm saying that because it's a beautiful ending of a person's life. Endings are like sunsets. Do you like the sunsets here in Western Australia? We face the Indian Ocean to our west. And sometimes those sunsets which we see here from Perth are beautiful, they're gorgeous. Up in the monastery where I live, it's up on the hills, and we get a great view sometimes over the ocean. Some of those sunsets are brilliant. For me, it's the best time of the day. His end. It's a beautiful sunset. Oh, I used to love this music, you know, these great symphonies. And it's at the end of the symphony when everything comes together. You get what we call the crescendo. And that's really moving. Just like the end of a person's life. When everything comes together, everything they've ever learned and known and grown comes together, and there it is. It's beautiful. To me, it's just putting a different perception on than one of the natural things of life. And just challenging. Challenging, because I like to be rebellious. I like to ask tough questions. I don't just take these things for granted. I challenge that death should not be something to be feared. No more than a sunset should be feared. We all know the sun's going to come up the next day. We all know the people come back again. Here we go again. And that's a truth. And that, of course, for me, it's just a great symphony has now been completed. Wow, that was brilliant. That was great. So changing the perception changes the whole idea of what is happening here. And as for the reincarnation business, look, we don't call it in Buddhism like a soul. We call it like a stream of consciousness. The idea of a stream of consciousness is that whenever you go across, say, you know, the Narrows Bridge or the Causeway, you look at that Swan River, it always looks the same. But we all know it's changed. The water under the bridge is never the same today as it was yesterday, but it looks the same. That is just like you, who you think you are. It looks the same. That's why you wake up in the morning and think, here I am again. But it does change. So much so, like the waters of the river. It's never the same one moment to the next. Same as you. To me, that's actually wonderful, because that gives everybody this great freedom to change, to grow. You're not tied down to your past. You don't have to be the same old person you were before. You don't have to be constricted, you know, by personalities, characteristics. Somebody said you're this, you said you're that. No, you've got total freedom to grow, change, and to be. That's why I say your future is totally free. There's no such thing as fate or destiny. You make your fate and destiny every moment. That was what we were talking about last week with the idea of karma. Karma means you have total freedom to make your future. And your future is being made right now. And that's a beautiful thing. That's a stream of consciousness. If your consciousness was something fixed, this is who you are, then that would really scare me sometimes. Oh my goodness, this is who I am. I've got to be like this for the rest of my life. I've got to be schizophrenic. I've got to be attention deficit disorder. I've got to be psychotic. I've got to be depressed. I've got to be this. I've got to be that. All those labels. That is one of the greatest difficulties which we face. It fixes us. It doesn't allow us any growth. That's like people in jail. You're not a criminal. You're not a murderer. You're not depressed. You're not schizophrenic. You're a person who's experienced schizophrenic episodes. You're a person who's stolen. You're not a thief. You're actually opening up great areas where you can grow and change. That's what we mean by the stream of consciousness. It grows just like a tree can grow. And if you cultivate it, if it's got good conditions, it can grow this way, it can grow that way. It's got a huge amount of openness and potential. To me, that's actually magical. The magic of our life. Doesn't matter how old you are. I've seen some people, 60 years of age or 70 years of age, they decide to start a career, become a lawyer or something at 70. And they do it. It's amazing. Just they show just what's actually possible for the human being. That stream of consciousness means you're not fixed. We can see just how it goes from cause and effect from one moment to the next. Just like the simile, which the best simile which I can give for how reincarnation works is a simile of the two mangoes. I like mangoes. It's been a good season for mangoes. And once I mention that, I'm going to get heaps tomorrow, I'm sure. But once, if you have a mango, okay, you eat the mango, and then you take the seed and you put it in your garden. And maybe a week later, you know, that mango splits and a little green shoot comes up. And you watch that green shoot grow until it comes above the ground. You've got a little plant, and it grows taller until it gets wooden on the outside. It's a small sapling. And it grows and grows after many months or years until the sapling goes bigger and bigger and bigger. More branches, more twigs, more foliage, until it becomes a tree. And then it has its flowers the first time. And after the flowers, you know, get pollinated, you get the little fruits, and the fruits grow. Little green things first of all, and they grow and grow, and then they get ripe and they get red. And you can smell them, they're getting juicy, they're just ripe enough, and then you can pick them and you eat it. What went across from the first mango to the new mango? Nothing went across. There's not one essence, not one molecule, probably not one atom, which was in the first mango and is now in the second mango. It's totally different. But there's a connection there. And that connection is a cause and effect process. Moment by moment, you can see that, you can witness that. How the first mango grows, the seed splits, the little green shoot comes up. You can see all those causes and effects. Every part of the process you can see, you can do the connection. And that's you, even in this life. Even in this life, you're not the same as you were when you were a kid. No, you can. Those of you who don't believe me, I think somewhere we still got in the library my 60th anniversary booklet. And my brother, he actually kept photographs of me even when I was a baby. And you can have a look in that book. He got photos of me when I was a baby, when I was a naughty kid, when I was a teenager, or actually not, in the early 20s, with big, I had this donut look. And I had this big mop of hair. And where my hair stopped, we had the beard. It was really useful in England because it was so cold in there. I had this beautiful sort of insulation all around my head. And I was just peering at the world through the middle with this big lot of hair. So you can actually see that in the book. I've changed a lot. And I will always change. Because of that, actually my jokes don't change, but most other things do. Actually, even the jokes, they do evolve. And actually, I was going to tell that story. You know about they always say that the two things which are most definite in life, the things you can trust in, is death and taxes. And I've been talking about death, so now I'm going to talk about taxes. Because I don't know if you heard the story of this. He was a minister for taxation, and he was walking back from some meeting, and he got mugged. This guy came up with a gun and told the minister of taxation. He didn't know who he was. He said, "Hand over all your money." And the taxation minister said, "Look, I'm the minister of taxation." "Oh, sorry, sir," said the thief. He pointed the gun and said, "Hand over my money," said the thief. Fair enough. So anyway, that was my jokes don't really improve. So now some things don't change. But the stream of consciousness, that's actually how it works. And when you see this stream of consciousness, already that consciousness, this is inside of you. Now the shell in which it's in, now this body, that is not so important to you. Which is why if you could only understand what this stream of consciousness is, this thing which is hearing me, which is listening to me, you know, the thing which is coughing or whatever you're doing, this is actually not you. So, you know, so inside of you, that's much closer to, you know, this stream of consciousness. But this body, is that really you? All of you are my age or older. You know, I'm 60 now. 60. Do you actually feel you're 60? Your body is, yeah, but your mind inside of you, what is that? So that's actually that we're sort of almost like imprisoned inside this male body, female body.
sort of Sri Lankan, old, young, whatever it is. But you know there's something inside you say, this isn't the real me, this body of mine. So when you change bodies, are you really upset? Because that's all it is, death. Just changing your body. Your body has passed its use by date. If you look somewhere, it's probably statinous somewhere. Best before. Have a look, see if you can find that number somewhere. Sometimes some people are well past their use by date. But you can see in there, so that's all it is. And it's wonderful to the sense, if you really understand what's happening, it's a sense of freedom when a person dies. Understanding that this should be, if you really are wise, and somebody calls you up and says, you know, your mother's just died or your brother's just died, if you're shocked, it means you're in denial about the reality of life. You're accepting life. And I don't know why people are shocked. Really, so yeah, I expected that. I expect that people can pass away at any time. That's what I expect. So there's no such thing as an unexpected death. I expect it to happen. And I expect that to happen to me as well. Because I expect it to happen to me as I expect it to happen to other people. That makes my life much more alive. Every moment is really important. So I don't plan too much in the future. There may not be any future. What is one of my favorite sayings, which I've said here many times, it's a great saying. Never do today what you can put off until tomorrow because you might die tonight. That's really profound. I mean that. Never do today what you can put off until tomorrow because you might die tonight. So things which you can put off till tomorrow, you know, the shopping and the messing around, I'm not quite sure how you spend your day. If this was your last day, how would you spend it? So you put off those things which aren't really important, and instead you do the things which are really important for you. What's important for you? Really important. You all know. Family, friends, being with yourself, just seeing the sunset, or whatever else it is. How much time have you wasted? Because, you know, you don't put off the things which should be put off. And the things which are really important, you haven't got around to them after all these years. Please get around to them soon. The things which you know, and I don't need to tell you what's really important in life. If you want to know what those things are, which are really important in life, next time you go to a funeral, listen to the eulogies. Because the eulogies show you what's important in life. Never once in all the funerals I've gone to, all the eulogies I've heard, I've never once heard people say how much money the person had in their bank account. It's not important. Never once have I heard a person say, and they had this amazing house, and they had a BMW car, and they had these stocks and shares in the market. No one ever says that at a funeral. That is not important. What's really important, they say, how generous they were, how loving they were, how you could always go around to them and they'd stop what they were doing and they'd just give you something to eat. I love this because so many grandmas and grandpas, they say that about them. Dear old grandma, you know, we would go out there and she was really tired and she would cook for us at any time of the day or night and cook what we wanted. Because that's how I remember my grandma. My grandma, I could go at any time of the day or night and she'd always cook me some chips. English, okay? My mother would tell her off. My son is, he won't eat his meal. It's bad for himself. And grandma said, no, if he wants chips, he gets chips any time of the day. It wasn't the chips which I loved. It was just her unconditional love. That is what's really important. And the forgiveness, the kindness. That's what's really important in life. So get that out of the way today. Don't put that off until tomorrow. How many of you today have told the people you live with how much you love them? How much you really care about them? How many of you have told your kids? Just what wonderful children they are. I bet none of you have. If this was your last day, you would do that, wouldn't you? Tell your parents, Mum, Dad, you've just been really great parents. I just want to let you know just how much I appreciate you. Your partner, yourself, how much you appreciate yourself. Why do we do that? Because that is what the whole idea of death brings to mind. The things which are really important, because that's what we remember when somebody dies. So that's why in Buddhism we call these things nothing to be afraid of. We call these things, there's a word for it called Devadutas, messengers of truth, messengers of the gods. These things. So if you've been fortunate enough to have a sudden death, it's a wake-up call. It's nothing to be afraid of, nothing to be rejected, but wonderful. It's reminded me that I must too, right now, do what is really beautiful, what is really wonderful. And the last little simile, it's a beautiful one from Ajahn Chah before we open this up for questions. If you haven't heard this before, this really shows what death and love are all about and how they are intimately connected. Ajahn Chah would hold up a cup. And he would say, because you know, in those days, even now, we don't sort of have PowerPoints or any special effects. He'd use whatever we have to make an incredibly profound point. He would hold up a cup and he would ask us, he said, can you see the crack in the cup? And we'd look and say, no, it looks like a perfect glass to me. And he'd say, it's got a crack in it. Microscopic crack, that's why you can't see it. One day, Ajahn Chah would say, someone will drop this glass, or they will kick it, and the crack will open up, and it will be broken, and not usable anymore. He said, because it's got a crack, that's why you monks should look after this glass. But if this was plastic, made of some unbreakable material, you could kick it, you could drop it, and it would never break. If it was permanent, unbreakable, you would not need to care about it. And then he made the beautiful connection. Just like human beings, we've each got a crack in us. It's called mortality. One day that will open up and we will die. It's not something to be afraid of, because if we were immortal, there'd be no need to care. Because we've got a crack, because one day we will die, we'll leave each other. Because of that, that is why we must care. Care today. Thank you, Death, for reminding me I must care. Thank you for listening. Very good. Now, again, I'm really trying hard to keep the talks a bit shorter, 45 minutes, but because these are broadcast internationally, it gives the opportunity for questions from overseas, and also any more questions here. So are there any questions anybody has from the floor here they would like to ask about the talk tonight? Okay, I think we're going to get some questions from internationals. So, Dennis, would you like to read out the first question?
Yeah, yes, and can I just say to members too, if you'd like to ask a question here, please just pop your hand up and we'll bring a microphone to you so that you can...
There's one at the back there. So,
yes, so just while that...
My microphone is coming over there. We're going to ask one of the internationals.
Yeah, in the meantime, Tim from the UK says, hello, BSWA and Ajahn Brahm. I'm a director of a Buddhist charity set up and try to find a place for bhikkhunis in England. If we found a place, do you think any of the bhikkhunis would come to England? P.S. Would you, Ajahn Brahm, be a patron of this charity?
Okay.
That's what you call a loaded question.
The last question, of course I'll be a patron of something which is so important. It is really important to try and open up the possibility for women to actually participate fully in Buddhism. And they're even nuns. This is a seminary here, which is not a bhikkhuni yet, but hopefully, you know, in a few years you'll become a bhikkhuni. So, you know, she's westernized Thai. So I've known her for a long time now. And we have, actually, we have bhikkhuni Satima. We have three bhikkhunis, but we are trying to train a lot more. And actually, we don't need volunteers, because there's plenty of women already want to be bhikkhunis, you know, to live the full monastic life. And look, I've been a monk for 38 years. I can really recommend monastic life. Incredibly beautiful, powerful lifestyle, helping other people and getting incredible, juicy happiness and insight yourself. It's a brilliant lifestyle. I want to, because I enjoy it so much, that's why I want to open it up to other people, including women. So that's why we did a lot of sacrifice to start a bhikkhuni ordination here in Australia. And I just was writing about this recently, that this was the first bhikkhuni ordination in our tradition outside of Asia, happened here in Perth. So you should also all be very proud of that. I had to sacrifice a lot of friends, you know, which and a lot of problems, as Dennis knows. But now we have bhikkhunis, but I'm saying this internationally as well. We also are trying to build up that monastery. There's not enough accommodation. We need a hall. We need a place for people to eat. So we've got this huge couple of $1 million project to try and build up Dhammasawa Nuns Monastery. So if there are any people who here in this audience or overseas who want to start helping our bhikkhuni monastery in Dhammasawa Gijigana, go and have a look. You know, we really do need some of those donations coming in. Because I was talking with Dennis earlier, it's just so incredibly expensive in Australia to build anything. And, you know, the money has not come in yet. So we really need to sort of try and get people to help out. And it is tax deductible for those people who want to think about Mr. Taxman. And in England as well. I was there recently and a lady told me things are very stark in England. They really too need some help creating some equity. I mean, to me it's crazy. I mean, this is the West. This is, you know, 2012. You know, my goodness, you know, there should have been equity a long time ago. So you know, at least we've started something here. Hopefully it's going to take off. And so we can have, you know, freedom. Let's say, did you see the article which was in the West Australian recently? They were talking about the Anglican Church having problems. And they mentioned me over there, just a sacrifice, which, you know, I'm just a figurehead, as many other people were helped with the bhikkhuni ordination here. It's really important that we actually, if you really love religion, to support it. And, you know, for women to be able to live, go to Gijigana, the Dhammasawa, and see what's going on over there. We're really trying hard to build this up. And the monks and nuns, we work really hard. Even this morning, like I'm over 60 years of age now. I'm senior monk. I do a lot of talking, writing books. You see all the books over there. And I'm trying to do the best. And even this morning, I was there just with the formwork of a little concrete slab. And I was building, you know, to save some money for the that was a retreat center. So, you know, we work really hard. I'm not just asking for money for the Dhammasawa Nuns Monastery because I'm fat and lazy. I work really hard. So do the nuns do. So please help out. And also, those of you listening in England, it's not a question of saying, yeah, we support these things. Get your checkbooks out and write some checks. You can't take it with you. So why not actually do something useful, something you can be proud of? No, that's one of the things which, when I die, talking about death, that's when you think, what have you done in your life? And sometimes I really think, what have I done in my life? I'm going to die really happy. You know, I've done a huge amount. So please join me and die happy by doing something that's really, really worthwhile. Anyway, sorry, yeah. So sorry getting on that, but I was actually thinking about that this afternoon, as Dennis knows. So I just took the opportunity. Okay. Yeah, have you got the are coming out. Okay. The microphone is coming to you.
I didn't know I was going to get a microphone, but I was just going to talk about you.
Please put the microphone to your mouth.
Bring up about being reborn, and a thought came into my head, if you're reborn, then maybe I'll write my will out to myself. What do you think?
You might what to yourself?
My will.
Might write your will out to yourself?
Yes.
No, write your will out to the Buddhist society
so
next lifetime you can become a bhikkhuni and it's all free for you then. Look, I know that those of you who know our society know that we have memberships, and please join us, members. We have life membership, you know, which is about six. But I've been trying for a long time. Look, we're Buddhists, for goodness sake. We should have seven lifetime memberships. So, you know, pay a bit extra, and then your next lifetime, you're automatically a member. So anyway, so please support, yeah. Okay, next question from...
Not so much a question, just... it looks like Shu from the USA just wanted to thank you for the talk tonight.
Okay.
So is there any other questions in the hall here? Can we have the microphone to this lady?
Right over here.
Ajahn Brahm. Where is the origin of this consciousness? Where does it go to? And what happens when there's no more human bodies for it to grow in?
Okay, this is the other type of evolution. You know, for me, that sometimes said, how does Buddhism, you know, deal with, like, evolution, which is obviously a truth? Evolution is just like the evolution of the vehicles in which we can get reborn into. And, you know, the world is much bigger than that. One of the my joys when I was young was actually to study theoretical physics and actually to see from that, you know, okay, this Big Bang, but it's obvious it wasn't the first Big Bang. And, you know, that is actually part of modern physics. This is not the only universe which we've been in or which has ever existed. There's a whole series of linear universes, parallel universes. So just like a long time ago, you know, people say in China thought that was the only land, you know, that people in sort of Europe thought, you know, this was only land, and you know, these other things that didn't really exist. We were the center of the universe, and then eventually we found that sort of, you know, the Earth, we thought the Earth was the center of the universe, and then we thought at least, you know, the solar system was the center of the universe, and of course now we realize we're not the center at all, we're not even close to the center, we're in just, you know, some sidetrack, some insignificant arm of an insignificant galaxy in a really sort of downtrodden area of the whole universe. You know, we're not special. So why do we think that this universe is special? That this one universe, no, this one from Big Bang, 14,000 million years ago, and it's not special. This universe evolves, but the beings inside, you're not the body. And so that whole stream of consciousness, when you really get to understand, and that's what we do in meditation, we really get to know that directly, what that actually is. Number one, that's independent of the body. That's why your body dies, and that mind stream of consciousness continues. That's why people do have near-death experiences. So look, I'm telling you, when you die, you'll carry on. At least that's what it feels like. Floating outside of your body, being able to see everything, but you've died. Your body's gone. The driver is outside the vehicle. And then you go on incredible journeys. Now, not the vehicle which you're used to, what they call mind-made body. And you can come and get another body if you wish. It doesn't have to be a human body. There's a whole range. Let your imagination fly. This human world is just a tiny part of the cosmos. And of course, if these human bodies are no longer left, I think just recently I remember reading, they're saying the number of even planets in this universe is greater than the number of stars. And I remember a long time ago, it was 10 to the 11th number of stars, they reckoned, in this universe. That's 10 with, you know, 11 zeros. Huge number. So of course, as many of those planets will have other beings in them. It's obvious. So there's many other places one can go. Basically, there's so many possibilities. So it's endless. So where did it come from? Where did the stream of consciousness come from? And have this idea, it's a great concept to get your heads around, the evolution of consciousness. Not the evolution of a body, but the evolution of consciousness. Basically, the spiritual development of the being. I'm not even calling it human being. As you evolve in those different lives. And it tells me what the meaning of this life, or many lives, are. To learn, to grow, to understand. And what you're learning, what you're growing, in more the real meaning of love. I know that many people think you understand what love is, and as you don't. You're just scratching the surface. But every now and again you come across moments of incredible, powerful, deep love. Peace, bliss, joy, the whole thing comes together in one. And you know that's really important. For some of you, that's the most important thing in your whole life so far. Spiritual experience of immense oneness, love, at peace, whatever, with everything. And you're learning. But you've got some way to go. And that's what you're learning in this life. Sometimes life after life it takes for you to grow, to learn, to be able to forgive. Somebody may have hurt you very, very, very badly. You can forgive. That shows you're really learning, you're growing. Sometimes it's very painful. But you don't think of your pain, you can help others. You know those amazing things which you read about and see? Things which just lift you up and think, wow, that is incredibly beautiful and powerful that you've witnessed something like that. And that's the meaning of life. And that's where you're growing towards. Maturing, blossoming, flowering. And it takes many lifetimes to do that. One is obviously never enough. And one is just so quick, one lifetime. To be able to learn truth, love, peace, freedom. You know, just one lifetime is not enough. You have to really go again and again, deep, deep, deep into these things. And you know you're going in that journey. That's why you're all here this evening. Topping up on your lessons about your spiritual development. You are evolving. Consciousness. That's beautiful. A nice way of looking at life. Does that make any sense to you? Very good, thank you. Yes, over here. Can I have a...
Some words of wisdom from you, if you will. Let's say there is a family member who is about to turn 88 who has poisoned everybody in her family, and we often think about, okay, well, she's 88, it's nearly the end. But obviously that's not really a compassionate way of looking at one's life. At the same time, what it would be like for her to continue her life. You said one life is too short, but for the rest of the family members, that 188 years of life has been way too long for so many people. Obviously, it's maybe off topic, but if you could give me some words of wisdom.
Okay, yeah. The 88-year-old member of your family has caused you great pain and suffering many, 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 many times. Now is the time to let go of that past. With the suffering which people cause you, they should only cause it to you once, when they actually do it. Every time you remember it and you dwell upon it, you're allowing them to hurt you again. So there's the way to actually to minimize that hurt, and it's not changing her, it's changing oneself. Because you can't change her. You tried many times and you just got frustrated. Change yourself, the way that you look at that. Whatever's happened in the past, you let it go. I don't say you forget. But you say, just that's happened, it's a learning experience, I'm going to grow from that, I'm never going to do that. So you don't allow other people's stupidity other people's cruelty to stop you from being happy and at peace. It was a great realization for me to realize that no one has the right or the power to control my happiness. My happiness is my concern. What other people do, say about me, that's their job. That's their concern. My happiness, my peace is completely under my power. I can say anything, do anything, whatever, but my peace, my happiness is mine. Don't let her control your happiness. You can do that by changing your attitude. And once you can do that, you can teach the other family members. And after a while, maybe that she may get the message. Okay, maybe one last question, then we'll have the... it's a tough thing to do, but you can do it. Yes.
Thank you for your words tonight. My question is in relation to the life force that leaves our body, and
yes,
you've referred to that as being a ghost, which I believe does occur. But my question for you is, the ghosts that you've referred to have a strong awareness of their life. They're carrying on in the same manner, with the same personality and the same feelings and the same knowledge that they had in their mortal body. And now they're a spiritual force that can affect other people at that time, in that place that they have lived. At what point does that old soul from the previous life enter a new life?
Okay, that's a really nice question. It was a tradition in Buddhism, traditional Buddhism. I used to say 49 days was the usual time after a person died before they took rebirth. And once in all the years I've been a monk, I found out that for one person that was actually true. Because this lady died in Thailand, she and her father was a treasurer of our monastery. So we knew she was dying, you know, cancer. She's a very young lady, in her 20s. Tried everything to look after her, but she eventually died. So I knew the day she died, you know, did the funeral ceremony for her. And it was, you know, some time later, her father came really early in the morning, and he actually came to speak with me. I said, "Why are you coming to the monastery so early?" And he said, "Look, I had to come. I came on the first possible vehicle because something weird happened this morning." And he said that we were having our breakfast, like in Asia, sitting on the floor with all the dishes in front of you. And there's about 12 or 13 people or 14 people in the house. And he said, one of my other daughters, you know, just, you know, chatting around, mentioned, I said, "I had a really strange dream last night. I dreamt my sister came to me in my dream and said that she spent enough time here, now she was taking leave and going." And at that, everybody stopped eating. And one by one, every person in that house said they had the very same dream. Same dream, no difference. And so the father, the head of the house, came to see me and said, "What happened?" He said, "Obviously she's taken leave, it's time for her to go." And because I knew the whole family so well and the whole circumstances, straight away I looked at the calendar and it was exactly 49 days which she said she was going to leave. There's no coincidence there possible. 12 or 13 people, it could have been 14 or somewhere around that number. They left at that time. But it doesn't have to be 49 days. It can be more, it can be less. That seems to be about the time. Basically, look, now, if you died, just imagine that you died, you'd be really concerned about the people you left behind. Now, that'd be your main sort of concern. You know, the people you love so much, you don't want to have them suffer. So your job is actually to be there for them until your family release you. So, you know, those of you who have loved someone recently, you know, that you think about that person, you release them, say, "Look, you know, okay, we're really distraught that you've died, but, you know, we get over it. Time for you to go. Don't hang around here because you will keep them there. And it's really unfair that you keep them because of your own suffering. No, it's time for them to go, to be free. Which is why that you free them. You know what it's like? It's one of those parts of the funeral ceremonies where I think it's brilliant. You know, get a balloon. Everyone gets a balloon and they just release the balloon. The very act of letting something go is a cue for the psychology of letting the real person go from your hearts. Let them be free. The greatest act of love we can ever give to someone else is to free them, to let them go. So just raise our love. Just be free. Go. Just go with our love wherever you go in this world or any other world. In the same way you may have a daughter or a son or a close loved one and they're going to take some amazing job in Paris or somewhere. Yeah, you'll miss them, but they're going to be such a lovely time. Maybe your daughter, your son. Go, daughter. Give them a big hug. Go. Have a great time in Paris. And as soon as they go through the door of to the immigration, you burst out crying, but you're so happy. They're gone. They're going to have a wonderful time. You have to free them, no matter how much it hurts. As soon as you can free them, the sooner they can go and get a much better place. Does that sort of answer your question? It didn't quite, I think, because obviously... Oh, when you die physically. Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's an interesting question. Even dying is not a momentary thing. Have you ever been with someone who's dying? It's an amazing thing. Yeah, there may be a moment they stop breathing, but the whole death process is a very smooth, long-lasting, over a minute or two. It's a process. It's not an event. Nothing in life just happens. It's a whole process. You can't just suddenly stop a car. It takes, you know, many meters before it comes to a halt. It's a beautiful thing getting this idea of not events in life, but processes of life. So that's actually what happens with even death and also rebirth. This whole process, an evolution, the same way that a plant grows. It doesn't suddenly, a mango appears. This whole process of cause and effect. And we actually see the whole part of it, the whole flow of it. Life isn't an event. You know, just like you don't get married. The whole marriage is just many months, maybe weeks, and it's just a whole flow of things. It's not a momentary thing. Nothing happens in a moment. It's all smudgy and smeary, not sort of particular. Okay, but thanks for that question, and thanks for allowing me to speak. So now we do.